all club members, guests, and also students from the journalism schools in Hong Kong. This is the first time we've done this kind of panel aimed at a particularly professional topic. We thought it was a different format from our usual club lunches to do at this time of night and have a maybe short on speeches and with the emphasis on a discussion, exchange of ideas. I'd like to introduce panelists. Phil Chetwynd. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself. My name's Eric Wishart. Phil Chetwynd, who's the Asia-Pacific editor of AFP, Agence France-Presse, which basically means he's responsible for coverage from everything from Afghanistan through to the South Pacific, China included. Thomas Crampton, former journalist, New York Times and International Herald Tribune, now the top social media expert at Ogilvy, who will explain a bit from a different perspective, maybe more from the corporate perspective, of how social media has changed the whole dynamic with communication. And Andrew Lavallee, who's a special projects editor at the Wall Street Journal and who particularly specializes in media and technology. So we all know what we're talking about, social media, the impact on the media, which has been dramatic. We quoted the Arab Spring, the coverage of the London riots, and also how so much news came out after the China train crash that wasn't in the official media that came out on the Sina Weibo microblog site. So it's a very much a hot issue. Even just 2 or 3 days ago, Charles Chow from Sina the head of Sina was talking about how they're going to have to start looking at ways of controlling the spread of information through the Weibo site. So it's very much an issue that's a hot issue that's affecting all of us in the media business. So I think to start, maybe I might ask Phil just to open the discussion by describing a bit how the social media, Twitter particularly, has affected news gathering in a major news organization like AFP.
Thanks, Eric. I started making a few notes on this subject, just trying to look at, a little list really of the ways in which our use of social media has changed the way we report, gather information. And I kind of expected I was going to make 3 or 4 or 5 points. And as I went along, I kind of stopped at about 10 or 12. And the conclusion was that it's influenced absolutely everything we do as a news organization day after day. Our whole way of reporting and gathering the news has completely changed. And for me, by far the most powerful example of this is really what has been happening in the Arab world this year, which has just been extraordinary. You've had country after country that is basically having some form of revolution. And I think it's not unrealistic to say that these changes that are happening in the Middle East would never have happened without the power of social networks. We talked about the Twitter revolution in Iran. We've talked about the Facebook revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, and we have the situation in Syria, which is actually the most extreme situation. It's actually astonishing what is happening in Syria. And what's really interesting is to compare what's happening now with what happened in the 80s, where very similar events were happening, but basically no one knew about it. In 1983, the Syrian government attacked the town of Hama in the south and killed 30,000 of its own citizens, about. This was first reported, I think, in the Western press, probably 2 weeks later, with a few paragraphs saying a couple of hundred people had been killed. After 2 weeks, it was 1,000. A year and a half later, Amnesty International came out with a report that said 30,000 people had been killed. There are almost no images of this. There are almost no video images of this. It's almost as if it didn't exist. This time around, the same scenario is happening again. Hafez al-Assad's son, Bashir al-Assad, is attacking the town of Hama, or has been to some degree. The foreign media is banned, as it was in 1983. So the only witnesses are the people in the town. And whereas last time the journalists couldn't link up with the people in the town to tell the story, this time the people in the town are telling the story in their own words. And they're incredibly organized. There are 7 or 8, 10 different Facebook, Twitter accounts that day after day are feeding images, accounts, witness, eyewitness accounts to the media around the world. They're briefing them day after day, and they're astonishingly accurate and well-informed. So our job has really been to try to collate, index, and verify this work. But the journalism on the ground is basically being done by the people, and our role has changed. And it's a revolutionary change. And what's happened now is completely different. The government cannot react in the same way as it reacted in 1983. It cannot kill 30,000 people in that city, because the whole world is watching through YouTube videos, through images that are being uploaded on Twitter, Flickr, and elsewhere. And it's quite an astonishing story. And that has been mirrored right across the Middle East to some degree. It's more extreme in Syria, but certainly in Tunisia, Egypt, and so on. That's a very extreme case, and it's an example to everyone. But I think it just shows the power of social media and how it is changing the way that we work day to day. Do you want to move on from it?
Yeah, Phil, thanks. I think we'll come back to you on some of the issues that raises. But Andrew, from a newspaper point of view, how a newspaper which is obviously a very, very strong online presence, the Wall Street Journal, how has the social media phenomenon affected your operations?
There's a couple of different ways that we use social media at the Journal. And I think in large part it is a response to changes in news consumption that we see with our audience. There are still a couple of people who are still opening a newspaper or visiting a site that they've bookmarked, but we've seen a huge increase in people who are looking at what their friends are reading on Facebook or checking out tweets from people that they're following to get a sense of what the important news of the day is. And so our goal is to be in those places too. We have worldwide quite a few accounts, primarily on Facebook and Twitter. Some of those are automated. Our ones that have the biggest audience tend to be run by an actual human, 24 hours. We also are doing, to a lesser extent, use of Facebook and Twitter in other languages, Hindi, Korean, particularly in Japanese, where Twitter works really well because of the compactness of the language. And then in some more regional areas, we're using Sina Weibo in China, in mainland China. And in New York, we've done some experimenting with Foursquare. So part of what we're doing here is the idea is to use these tools to help grow our audience. A lot of times we encourage reporters to be sharing links to stories that they've written. A lot of reporters like doing this. It helps them develop their audience. It keeps them in the conversation with sources and readers. And often we're asking them to link back to their coverage. We do sometimes participate in sort of community and discussion on these forums, but really the goal is to get people reading Wall Street Journal stories. There are some exceptions to that. There are times when reporters have been out in the field and for the purpose of sort of getting through to readers, it made more sense for them to tweet something directly. We had an example of that when the tsunami hit. We had a reporter that left from Tokyo basically with the clothes on his back. He was not always in a position where it was easy for him to file. And so he started tweeting, posting photos that he saw when he was out there. This is someone who got 20,000 followers in a couple of days as a result. And we really saw that there was, that people were sort of desperate for this immediate feedback. And that was something that social media really helped us do. There have also been times, recently there was an attack in Afghanistan where one of the reporters on the scene, again, wasn't in a position where he could file a full-length article quickly, but he was able to tweet some details of what he saw. This is something that I would say we're still kind of figuring out at the Journal and probably at a lot of news organizations. When does it make sense to push something directly through these channels? When does it make sense to sort of encourage people to visit our site or to be consuming our content directly? But that gives you an idea of some of the different ways that we're sort of thinking through and trying to channel these outlets.
Okay, thank you. Just one question following up just on what you said there. When your journalists tweet directly, they're not going through any editorial system. I mean, the Wall Street Journal obviously has a very tight editorial control in what's published to ensure accuracy. What's the philosophy within the journal on that?
We do have some fairly basic editorial guidelines about social media. And I won't read through the policy right now, but they're fairly common sense, and they're basically revolving around the idea that these are conversations that happen in public. And regardless of what your privacy settings are, that's something that you want to keep in mind. Reporters are generally not tweeting stories that they haven't published yet. They're not saying something that they haven't seen firsthand. We try to sort of basically get them thinking about these common sense rules the same way that they would in a public forum.
Okay, thanks. Thomas, from your perspective, you work for a long, very experienced journalist. Now you're looking at it from another side. Could you explain a bit how the corporate world's handling this?
Sure, and maybe also look at a little bit from the journalism's point of view, having made that transition myself, just very briefly about what I do to avoid any confusion about that. I was a journalist. I left that. Now I run social media in Asia Pacific for Ogilvy & Mather, which is a marketing and advertising company. And the role of my team is to help companies to understand, strategize, and execute in social media. So it's helping them to leverage these new platforms. Coming back to journalism, I think that social media really comes as a challenge both to journalists and to publishers or people who formerly could sell content at great premiums. And I think in terms of, from the journalist perspective, it's a transition going from a one-way communication, broadcast-style communication, into understanding a conversational-style communication, where you are putting out something that is maybe not entirely developed. You're maybe putting out more questions than you are answers. And that's something, the experience that I went through myself when I left the Herald Tribune and New York Times. I focused entirely on my own blog, and for several years I never wrote anything except for my blog. It was like an actual decision. And I experimented with many styles of writing, many approaches to try and engage people. And that really became the measure of success, was not the number of readers, but really the amount of engagement that you would have on a particular posting. In terms of the challenge to publishers, the difficulty is that it's really hard to engage and monetize across a social media platform. You're trading print dollars for digital cents in terms of the advertising. But a further trouble that I would see is something further down the road, which is, is what my team is involved in and what we're actually doing, which is the creation of content. And this content can be things that are of great interest to people and would have been something that formerly would have been available to them through a publisher of some sort. And I think that creation of that content is actually going to be more of a challenge moving forward if you don't have a differentiation as a content creator. The good news, however, is that I think that tablet computing is a very interesting development. The iPad is an example of that, where you have a platform that is very good at displaying content, and people seem willing to pay a premium for that. So that's one sort of positive side of that.
I mean, one of the problems is obviously accuracy. So, these social network sites are great sources of information, but they're also great sources of disinformation or just complete fabrication. How does a news organization handle that, Phil?
Well, I mean, I think people overcomplicate the way they view social media platforms. at the end of the day, if you get some information from any source, it's your job as a journalist to verify it. It doesn't really matter where it comes from. If you found a photo on the floor, you wouldn't publish it until you verified where it had come from. Likewise, the sort of the classic old school journalism thing, when somebody died, you used to knock on their door, go in, talk to the family, and the family would give you a picture, right? Again, you wouldn't publish that picture until you could ascertain where it had come from, if it was accurate, if it really was the person that it was purporting to be. And it's exactly the same for social media. We use photos, videos, and so on that we pick up from various social media sites. We don't use them without verifying them. We don't use them without speaking to the people who've taken them. We don't use them without getting their permission, written permission, where possible, before going ahead. So I think some of the pressure comes from the fact that we live in such an instant communicative world. We expect to have answers instantly. We expect our news to come within seconds. And so the pressure is on journalists to put things out quickly. But at the end of the day, it's really about the same journalistic procedures that we've all been trying to do since the beginning. You don't put information out till it's verified.
Andrew?
Yeah, just to echo what Phil said, you know, I would expect that journalists use social media in a smart, skeptical way. The reporters who are active on Twitter for us, they are usually not tweeting anything that they haven't either reported or witnessed. And the ones who are retweeting or sharing content from other people, they will make clear if it's coming from another source or if it's something that they haven't verified, or that's something we would ask them to do.
Thomas, if you get any advice you could give to journalists of all ages, really, of what's the best approach to social media, to having your own private presence on it and how to use it? I know it's a big subject, but is there any way you could maybe explain it? Because it's always a question on Twitter when it mixes with your professional profile and your personal life. You say you don't have multiple accounts, right? You've got one account. That's always a bit of a dodge. You can have a professional one and a private one. But, I mean, how do you see, I mean, how an individual journalist, how should they manage their own private, their own social media accounts, and also how should they use social media?
First, if I could talk a little bit about the question you asked before about the reporting and confirming things.
Yeah.
I think one interesting phenomenon with social media is that you really, if you're a company, it's difficult to get away with lies. Truth comes out. And that's why transparency is extremely important. What happens, there's examples again and again and again of companies that said something that wasn't true. This is the internet. Get over it. Somebody's going to figure it out, and it's going to be found. So the being upfront and honest about things is an absolute necessity operating in this new world. In terms of journalists getting into social media, the most important thing is just to try and test it out. And journalists should clearly build up their own presence online, which, as you were highlighting, can be a bit of a contrast to what their own employer is doing. Are they supposed to build up their employer's brand? Are they supposed to build up their own personal brand? If I were an employer, I would want people to build up the employer brand. If I were an individual journalist, which is what I would speak much to, I would say build up your own presence, build up your own brand name, because you really have to have a unique voice and a unique presence out there if you're going to stand out in any way.
And using social media as a source, it's just something we can't avoid now. How do you see that impacting the coverage of China?
China is a really interesting case because social media plays an outsized role in China right now. China has one of the highest levels of social media engagement in the world, bar no country on earth. And sometimes when I'm giving a talk, I will speak to a bunch of students, for example, at university. They'll say, "Oh, it can't be. It must be U.S. Must be somewhere else." And I'll poll the room and I'll say, "Okay, of all of you here, how many have watched any of the CCTV channels in the last 2 weeks?" No, none of the students raised their hand. You ask them, "Okay, who has watched Youku or Tudou, sort of the rough equivalents of YouTube, in the last 24 hours?" And everybody raises their hand. So, in part, due to the stultifyingly dull state-run media dictatorships aren't known for making lively media environments, combined with the inability of people to express themselves elsewhere, has resulted in this new public forum of the internet and social media sites. Interestingly, a lot of them are not Renren or Sina Weibo even, you know, the latest trend ones. They're old-fashioned BBSs where you'll get long conversations going on about things, and you can find out incredible amounts of things about what people in China are thinking about and what they consider as important.
Andrew, anything to add to that?
I would say what we're doing with social media in mainland China is fairly limited to sharing our articles. We're active on Renren and Sina Weibo. We basically kind of leave it at that. I don't know that we're using it so much as a reporting tool, but more as a way to kind of grow our audience.
Well, you did quote, I saw you quoting Ai Weiwei in one of your articles quite recently, in August, I think, and it was through Twitter, I think.
Right. In that case, we continue to see Ai Weiwei's use of social media as part of the story with him. The fact that he was basically told not to be using Twitter, and he's right back out there. That's something that we wanted to cover.
And as a news agency, Phil, how
well, I mean, just to mention the Ai Weiwei, I mean, that's what we're seeing all over the world, is people, be they celebrities, be they newsmakers themselves, going on Twitter or Facebook and actually getting their information out, not via the media, on their own. My favorite story of the year was Wayne Rooney had a hair transplant this summer. And it was huge news, actually. But now this would be classic sort of tabloid fodder in Britain. If some tabloid journalist found this out, he would have been rumbled, and it would have been extremely negative press coverage. And he just took the offensive, went straight out there. He's got 500 followers on Twitter. He came out and said, had a hair transplant today, feeling great, fantastic. And he completely dominated the way that story was reported. And it's gone. I mean, you know, it's sort of, oh, great, Wayne Rooney has a hair transplant. And that's it's over. So, and you see this time and time again. The Thaksin Shinawatra, again, a prominent tweeter, putting messages out himself. The Taliban spokesman last week. The Taliban spokesman and the NATO spokesman last week were having an ideological battle on Twitter. They were bypassing us. We were supposed to be... Normally, we ring them up, get the quotes, both sides, put them in the story, and tell everybody exactly how they're supposed to feel, but actually they were just out there themselves arguing online, and you know, they didn't really need us anymore. So it's interesting how, you know, be they sports people, celebrities, newsmakers, governments, politicians, are actually finding that they can actually express themselves better around us just by going straight on Twitter and other social media platforms.
But it also has to be said that the reason they like to do that is because they're avoiding the check that the media would bring. You know, is that true that you you had that hair transplant? Or not? That's not a good example. But sure. I guess you could tell if it's a hair transplant.
No, it's true. But that's a concern. That's a concern for the media, because they found that they can communicate with the public without us. You know, before we own that space. You know, you have to speak to us so we can communicate your message to the public. And in the course of the interview, we're going to ask you some nasty questions. Whereas now they've realized they can just go around us and probably get their message out anyway. You know.
And do you think that's a threat for the traditional media, that, you know, with the new generation, they might just bypass it and just get all their information through Twitter feeds? Or?
I think that there's still a role for the traditional media, absolutely, but I think that it's a changed environment, and I think that the traditional media, so-called traditional media, I mean, it's hard to call it traditional media anymore because they've changed so much. I mean, look at all the stuff that you guys are all doing. It's very, very different. But it is a new environment. And the value of that media and what it brings to that mix is going to change.
I think it potentially is a threat. But one of the ways that the media can sort of circumvent that is helping readers, viewers, our audience, whatever, cut through the noise. I mean, if you look at Twitter right now, it's a mess. It takes a while to figure out who is legitimate and who's not on there. And one of the things that we can be doing is helping them identify.
Any good anecdotes, Phil, on stories that about hair transplants that weren't from the real Twitter feed? Because I mean, there's a lot of people pretending to be Wayne Rooney out there that aren't. So how do you control that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does just come down to the basic journalism, that, you know, you don't pick up information from a Twitter account until you know where that's come from. It's the same as any source. It's the same as if you ring someone up. If you ring someone up in the middle of Afghanistan you've never spoke to and they tell you that President Karzai has been assassinated, you're not going to run the story. If you ring up that guy and you've known him 20 years, you know, your whole career, and he tells you the same thing, you're going to treat it in a different way. And that's exactly the same, the same principle as the way, you know, you should interact with social media. It's about the credibility of your source, whether that source is a social media source or a TV source, whatever it may be.
Okay, can I throw the discussion open to the floor? Can Diane, stop. Stormont. Oh, sorry, everybody, please identify yourselves.
Diane Stormont.
You don't need any introduction.
No, my question is, we've heard from AFP that you're obviously following Twitter accounts, various social media accounts, and at Wall Street Journal, your journalists are running their own social media accounts. Do either of your news organizations actually set up institutions where you are engaging with potential sources, with your readers? It's a bit different for AFP because you're a wholesaler, obviously. But maybe with your journalists, the stories are breaking. Do you, if there's a
sure.
a major event, are you live sure. streaming? Are you getting?
You're right. It is a bit different for us. I don't know about the Wall Street Journal, but I know what you mean. The idea of crowdsourcing information from you know, you have a report coming out. I suppose the example maybe that people think about is when the WikiLeaks cables were released, the Guardian, for example, called on its readers to help them to verify things and put the whole stash up there, and therefore had an arm. The idea that you can have an army of people reading the same information as you, and obviously you can read much more quickly. Doing that and having 20,000 eyes on a report will turn up things that a journalist combing through a report quickly will not find. Again, because of the situation we are in as a provider, not really, but I don't know if the Wall Street Journal does.
I would say this is a work in progress, but social media has definitely affected our coverage at times. We have the sort of institutional account is twitter.com/WSJ. And so we see responses to that all day long. There have been times where readers have corrected us when they've spotted an error that we had missed somehow. There have been times where we have updated stories based on what was coming in there. There's also been times where we've seen a sort of unexpected reaction in social media. One example recently was we had one of our book critics had written something sort of bemoaning the state of young adult fiction. This got a really heated reaction on Twitter, tons of people saying that they thought she was really wrong, and this sparked a sort of rebuttal column that ran. That's something that just wouldn't have happened before social media because we probably wouldn't have seen that reaction so quickly. But this is a case where when people are paying attention to the right places in social media, it can sort of help us get something that our readers are saying. I mean, there have been times when we've asked people to comment and use Twitter as their forum, and then we keep an eye on it. There's also events. Twitter's probably the one that we find has the sort of most immediate reaction. That's where the audience is biggest, and that's where people are sort of doing the most.
Tom?
One zone I would love to see develop more is around data and data visualization. With social media, you suddenly get, and it's not just in China, but it's particularly true in China, You get access to incredible amounts of insights about people's behaviors, trends, what they're looking at, what they're doing. On a small, I mean, just one tiny example, you can see the trends of, you know, if you look at two kinds of drinks, Coca-Cola and Red Bull, and see when people are talking about them the most on Facebook. It's interesting that, you know, Wednesdays, everyone's talking about Coca-Cola. I guess it's because they're all saying, you know, I'm tired, it's the middle of the week, I need a Coke. By Saturday, they're all talking, not surprisingly, that's the Red Bull day. That's sort of a very small and insignificant example of some of the things that you can find out about what people are looking at and what they're doing. And if you can visualize those in a very compelling way, it can provide tremendous insight, particularly in a country like China where it's so hard to get any information.
Don't Don't lose your microphone, Tom.
So for those of us who are still semi-Luddites, despite Diane and HKU's best intentions, Tom, I want to ask you to separate for us, please. A typical day, there are two ways to use social media if you're a journalist. One is the incoming stream of social media.
Sorry, excuse me, you didn't identify yourself.
Sorry? Sorry. Robin Meredith with Bloomberg now.
Okay, thanks.
So there are two ways to use social media, it seems to me. One is the incoming stream of information you get from it, and the other is the outgoing stream that either you send or that companies send. Will you tell me about your typical day in the social media plateau? What do you do to get incoming news, and what do you do about outgoing if you're a journalist and then if you're a company?
I think you're identifying two sort of uses, separate uses. One is incoming and outgoing. I don't do one before the other. I do all of them all the time. And usually on my mobile phone. I guess I would say it's not about sending in so much maybe sending information in sort of the classic news sense that I spend some of my time doing. It's sending data points of certain kinds. Like you can check into a location using a location-based service like Foursquare. Or you can retweet something that you find interesting on Twitter. Both of those are things that I would tend to do via my mobile phone.
So you wake up, you have a cup of coffee, then you do.
Yes, yes. Basically, I go to social media and I often find things first on social media before I find it in the newspaper.
Andrew? Or you go in the social media, then you have your cup of coffee.
My guess is probably a lot of us, you wake up and then spend the next 16 hours unsuccessfully managing the onslaught of the inbox, phone calls, social media feeds, news wires, and whatever else is in your day, and then squeeze out some time to do reporting, writing, and editing. For me, it's another couple of tabs that I have open when I sit down. It's something that I look at when I'm in the elevator. On my phone, it's kind of just another place where I'm checking in and keeping an eye on things from time to time.
But are you suffering from information overload, as they say? Is it too much? Or?
I mean, of course it's too much.
I also think it depends what kind of role you're doing in journalism. I think if you're kind of on the editor side, the kind of the endless monitoring, watching stuff come in and so on is extremely hard to manage because it is limitless and you can just sort of waste a tremendous amount of time. You can also find real nuggets as you go along every day. But I think sometimes on the reporting side in particular Twitter, the ability to build sources, the ability to actually communicate with people in a sort of, because you're in their network and you're messaging them directly, there's a sense of community. People tend to respond to you because you're communicating on Twitter in a way that they wouldn't respond maybe if you're writing them an email or something like that. So I think it does make a difference what your role is. But that is a massive challenge for the people who work for me complain it all the time. It's a huge challenge. You sort of get to the end of the day and you've forgotten to pick up the phone or go outside, and if often people think if they're ever going to write a story, they might just have to go somewhere without a computer, without any kind of network availability to actually focus on the actual work in hand, because it is a real time suck if you don't manage it properly.
I remember not that long ago when you waking up in the morning and you were in charge of a region or whatever, Your first source of news was the BBC World Service. You had that wonderful music came on and then they read it and it was like the voice of God coming down, and that was basically the news agenda for the day.
I still listen to the BBC World Service while I'm brushing my teeth. It's great.
Yeah, but before you brush your teeth or after you brush your teeth, how do you, before you come into the office, the day has started already. So how do you organize your first contact with news in the morning? How do you organize your Twitter feeds?
My first contact would be, I guess, through a reader, through your Google Reader or Pulse Reader on the iPad. the ability to skim every single headline. And sorry, I don't read more than the headlines in the Wall Street Journal, but the ability to read the first paragraph and the headlines of the Wall Street Journal, FT, BBC, Reuters, whatever, in about 5 minutes, which would come from the readers. Once you've done that, you can have your cup of coffee, because, or not, if there's something that you need to run and deal with immediately. But yeah, the ability to sort of really consume a tremendous amount of information, or you know, albeit in a surface way, very quickly. That would be my first port of call.
One thing I would add too is one way that I help from it being overwhelming is, and one thing I really love about this stuff is the social aspect. I don't follow 10,000 people on Twitter. I follow maybe 100 or 200, and a lot of those people are pretty quiet unless they see something important. And so these people help me sort of see in things that are relevant to me bubbling to the top. And it's also a reason that I encourage people who I work with to be active on these sites. I may miss something, but if 10 other people sitting around me are also following other relevant outlets, then chances are some of us will flag this.
We've got a question over here. Thanks.
Hi, Renita from RTHK. Question for Thomas. Should broadcast media, radio, be thinking differently in terms of social media strategy than print or TV? And if so, how?
Wow, tough question.
Yeah.
Okay, the 3-minute business plan.
Okay.
I think that the main thing I would think that is important is to find ways of engaging audiences, because that's really at the end of the day, broadcast, particularly radio, is all about reach. Okay, we're reaching all these people in Hong Kong. Well, how many people are we actually engaging with? Forget about the people that happen to be listening. How many people are we actually getting a response from? And those are the people that I would be spending my time trying to engage with. And I would celebrate the fact that we can actually do that in Hong Kong. As when I was downstairs, one of the innovations I brought to the FCC was when I changed downstairs, we actually put the FT and the Asian Wall Street Journal in the men's room, easily readable when you're in there for a moment. And there was an article there talking about how the Supergirl broadcast in China had just been told they can't do voting online because there are 400 million people voting for the winner of this sort of equivalent of American Idol, which is that shows me they're being very effective at understanding how to engage with their audience. And if there's any government that understands what is engagement and how it works, it's the Chinese government. They're very, very savvy about social media. So that's, you know, that would be to me a case study of what really has worked quite well.
Rick Engwani, South China Morning Post. I'm just curious what the three of you think about what the future holds for large mass media organizations, large objective mass media organizations, given that you don't need a printing press to get the word out these days. You don't need a big broadcast operation such as yours. And looking at the success of organizations like Fox, and what Jeff Jarvis, I think it was, who said recently that transparency is a new objectivity. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Andrew?
I don't have my microphone, so I can't answer. Sorry,
you're not that easy. That's too easy, you know. That doesn't work.
Sorry, I'm not totally clear on the question.
Given all the information that's out there through social networks and all that, what's the future of an organization, a newspaper organization? That's the question, basically.
These large mass media so-called objective organizations to tell us what to think, to borrow a quote from Phil.
I think readers will tell us. I don't know that social media is going to bring truth to the world all by itself. You know, we still need people who are skeptical, who are asking questions. If social media helps us do a better job or helps readers do a better job, I guess we'll find out.
I mean, I'm broadly optimistic because, I mean, the issue for us is trying to find someone or find a model that will pay us to do it. But I'm optimistic because, you know, the New York Times used to sell a million point five copies a day. They now sell a similar amount, maybe a little less. But at the same time, they got 20, 30 million readers around the world. So the demand for our journalism just grows. We just need to find a way to pay for it. So as long as there's a, you know, and whenever some massive event happens, people tend to go to proper news organizations. They tend to go to the BBC website. They tend to go to Yahoo News. They don't suddenly randomly search the net looking for information. So I mean, I feel optimistic about it. I'm just hoping some whizzes at Google or something are going to come up with a way to actually make sure we get paid for what we do.
Yes, you have to have journalism. Yes, you have to have it. You.
Yeah, we need a microphone here. Anyway.
So can I react to that quickly?
Well, you have to repeat the question because people at the back didn't hear it.
Well, yeah, I was just speculating, like, if does Andrew, say, have to run the News Corp story? I mean, so long as they're transparent, everyone knows about the affiliation. I mean, is it necessary anymore in this?
I'll react to the part of your question, which is about, you know, is the traditional media necessary? Is organizations that are going to call people to account? Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the worst aspects of the internet, which is the destruction of the business model for traditional media. And I think that it is a danger to society. I think it is a potential to undermine society and really hurt a lot that has been achieved over time. I think that if you don't have people who are able to do that, if you cannot finance investigative journalism, the world is definitely a lesser place, and there's definitely things that are going on that shouldn't go on. So it's absolutely a bad thing.
Okay.
I have two questions. I'm Paul Tyson from Bloomberg TV.
Okay.
The first we've kind of touched on, but it seems to me that network 24-hour rolling news, which is where I have a vested interest, is particularly prone to being damaged, if you like, by social media, in that social media is all about words and short clips of video and short clips of audio. So the question there is it eventually just going to kill 24-hour rolling news? And if it doesn't kill us, what do we do to survive? And the second question is more specific. Andrew brought up Foursquare, which is I think most people know, a location-based social networking system. And I'm interested to see what the panel, what successes they've had with that kind of technology, which is still relatively new in social media, less so about the news gathering side of it, because I think that's fairly obvious, is the person where they say they are, but more in how we broadcast back to people in specific locations and sort of hyper-local news and how you've done with that.
I mean, I
Tom, that sounds like a question for Tom, actually.
Thanks.
We'll get back to the other.
I can start with a little bit about what we have done with Foursquare. And I would say it's a fairly new experiment and pretty limited. But basically what we tried in New York was set a couple of locations so that when you checked into the place, we told you about a relevant news article that was based in the area. And I think that's something that, whether it's the journal who does it or someone else, there is some value to being able to sort of direct readers to things that are happening right around them, and using these tools to kind of get us to that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. There's lots of ways that you can use location very powerfully. If I were to know that I could check into Foursquare and see the reviews from five different restaurant critics that I trusted, whom I trusted, that would be something that I would find of value. In terms of the viability of the business model of 24-hour news, another 3-minute business model. I think that there definitely is value there, and it's all the context in which it's used. And you know, I find that in offices, if you have that in the background, you can have an eye on it and be doing other things, and you have a sense of what's happening.
Phil?
Well, Tom, one point I think that I better refer Tom to, because he was the one that particularly told me this, was how the different formats that they use on in China, video social networking. I mean, it isn't short, sharp images, as far as I can remember. It's longer form, right?
Yeah, in longer format. And I'd make a huge distinction between video and a lot of other things on the internet. Video is wildly compelling. The second largest search engine in the world is YouTube. So I think that the personally, I predicted the death of television about 4 or 5 years ago, and it keeps surviving my prediction. And it's which has kind of made me give up, because I think that video is fundamentally different in a strange kind of a way. I mean, have you ever been in like a taxi and there's one of those annoying screens in front of you? You can't look away from it. And I've learned subsequently that is actually due to your like deep parts of your brain thinking that it's some panther that's going to saber-toothed tiger that's going to jump out and get you. So you physically, it's actually, you cannot look away from it. It's not that you can't control yourself.
And I think formats are changing too. I mean, I think no one would have predicted the kind of little boom we're having at the moment in long-form written journalism. Everybody said the internet was going to dumb us down. We're going to write 400-word stories. And at the moment, partly because of the success of the iPad and other tablets, but various other reasons, there's quite a boom in long-form journalism. People are investing in it. Reuters, Newswire, never used to put anything out over 600 words. They're writing 3,000-word pieces, and other people are doing the same thing.
Can I do a quick test, Eric, if I might?
Okay.
I'd like to ask everyone in this room to raise your hand if you felt you've ever been on a social networking website and you sort of lose yourself and you spend much more time on it than you thought you had. Please raise your hand. Okay, I did this with a different audience, and it was quite a striking result. How many people has that happened to on a news website or a traditional publisher? Roughly half as many.
Yeah, not as many.
Which I'm not saying that that's a criticism, for example, of platforms for news or the publishers themselves. It might just be a nasty critique about us. We're just interested in our friends or something like that. It's interesting to note that there's this striking difference.
We have a question over here.
Thanks very much. Adam Harper from Credit Suisse. Could I ask the journalists who are here what they would like to have from big companies in terms of using social media to communicate directly with the media? And could I ask Thomas perhaps how he thinks companies can best make use of social media to communicate their messages to the public in a very broad sense, obviously?
Andrew?
To be honest, I don't know that I want my sources to be super active on social media. I'd rather they just give me exclusives.
Well, that's honest.
Kind of what we want from our sources is it's platform agnostic. We want them to be responsive, to be available, to answer questions when we have them. To not be hounding us on the phone when we're on deadline. I mean, these are all things that we sort of need regardless of whatever the tools at the disposal are.
Phil?
Speed, reactivity. Traditionally, companies, especially big corporates, have been always slow to react to news. I suppose people would think of perhaps BP during the huge crisis down in Florida. We work in such fast news cycles now. News cycles sometimes last an hour, half an hour. I mean, the longer people sit on news, the longer people don't react to news, the quicker the situation gets out of control. So the need to have just incredibly quick reactivity from companies, from governments, and so on. I mean, for their own good as well. I mean, there's the need to just completely speed everything up.
Tom?
I guess my recommendation is don't be annoying. The number of companies that think they're inherently interesting is quite frightening. They don't care about you. All they care about is what their objective is at that time. So try to find a way to communicate with them. And that's the beauty of social media is you no longer have to fill the poor guy's email box. You can present something in a format that is easy for them to find when they actually need it.
But Tom, there's a lot of interest in UBS.
So answer the phone calls.
Please. Hi. My name's Ali. I'm with a
multinational in Hong Kong. We've talked about how social media seems to be sort of transparency and at your doorstep, and you can get that information verified. One angle of the social media that I've seen, and I work for a company, is actually the reputation damage that misinformation causes. Back in the traditional media days, hark back to the good times, where if the journalist found a story, he or she would ring you and you could provide elements to that. A recent example of that was when the Airbus, Qantas Airbus, was flying to Australia and dropped one of its engines in Indonesia accidentally. The plane was fine, it's got four engines, so it traveled back to Singapore. But because the engine fell somewhere in Indonesia, social media was on it and said the plane had crashed, a Qantas plane had crashed, which, as you know, prides itself on safety as part of its track record. By the time the CEO got up in the morning, the share price was down. There were people ringing up his offices saying, Qantas plane fell, what are you going to do about it, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, there was no truth to that matter, and eventually found out. There are other examples of that where the social media has actually caused irreparable reputation damage that takes companies months, if not years, to bring back. How does one go about trying to, or how can the traditional media help in trying to counter that? Because one of the things I miss about the traditional media was the objectivity of the reporting, because there was a reputation attached, reputation premium attached where it was coming out. Now with Twitter, you can say whatever you want, and of course recant later, probably false and pretend to be someone. And whatever Wayne Rooney is doing, it's working because he's scoring goals.
Phil, I think you can answer that one. Tell me on the Qantas.
It's interesting you mentioned the Qantas, actually, because that the drop in the share price wasn't really caused by social media. It was caused by bad journalism by reputable news organizations, caught up in the moment and reporting inaccurately. And that is the challenge that the media faces at the moment with the very intense pressures of rolling 24-hour news, of instant communication. It's tremendously challenging to try to keep the same principles of journalism, the same standards that you have, when the TV in the corner is flashing at you that something has happened. I mean, I remember that day particularly well. The engine fell off. It was a classic 2 and 2 makes 5. Somebody on the ground said, "I heard a big bang," and that became the plane went down. When in actual fact, it was just an engine fell off.
That's just an engine falling off.
Yeah, just an engine falling off. But I mean,
not the same as a plane crashing.
But yeah. So I mean, but I have to say there were proper media organizations that reported that badly, and that is poor journalism. But as I said, some of the challenge there is how to deal with the immediacy and how to deal with the challenge of facing these time pressures.
I'd add to that. I mean, something that example seems to be, whether it's understandable or not, there's maybe these people who started that whole thing were not malicious. There's a further case where you actually have people who are malicious and are trying to harm the reputation of a company. And in that case, I don't think you can look to traditional media to solve the problem. It's a problem that started within social media. You need to solve it within that context. And that's something we've been involved in many, many times, where you're basically dealing with something that gets a momentum of its own on the internet. Everybody knows how that happens. And you have to find the right way to respond to that and to correct that. And the rule number one is listen. You know, what are people saying about you? Do you know today what they're saying about you? Do you know what the top search terms are for you right now? And if a company does know that, then they're much less likely to be caught up by it. And if they have a social media presence themselves, if they are active on these platforms and have a voice and can actually communicate, then they're much more likely to be heard, rather than wait until that, you know, the classic thing that happens is it you know, United, I don't know if anybody saw this, United breaks guitars. There's this video on YouTube. This guy who was traveling, very quick anecdote, was traveling in the U.S., changed planes while he was in Chicago. He saw the guitar getting thrown around. He arrives at his destination, and it's actually broken. He goes to complain about that, doesn't get listened to, gets the full run around, and finally says to the customer service person, "Okay, that's it. I'm going to put a video on YouTube." And the customer service is like, "Knock yourself out. Enjoy." So he made this video, which was, in my opinion, one of the best videos that he ever made. All the other ones were pretty awful. It's very amusing about how United broke his guitar. It sent the share price reeling, millions of views. So United found out about it off of the traditional media. It was too late. By that time, the whole thing had taken on momentum of its own. So if you're listening to what's being said in social media and you can react within social media, you've immunized yourself to a certain extent against what can be the worst.
Please.
I'm John Medeiros from the Cable and Satellite Broadcasting Association, CASBOC. I want to start with a little anecdote, too. About 6 weeks ago, a couple of Taiwan TV stations were fined by the government because in their news reports, they were just taking news from the social media. I don't know exactly which one, but they were just broadcasting what was appearing on Twitter or Facebook and, you know, assuming it was true. And in fact, in a couple of cases, guess what? It was wrong. So now my question is, Phil referred to the time pressure of the news cycle. And somebody else asked about, you know, how about broadcast media? Is there a difference between the different kinds of traditional media in the way you look at social media as a source? In this world, are broadcast media, news agencies more prone to feel that pressure than sort of traditional newspaper types? Or has the website, existence of a Wall Street Journal website and your reporters on tweets and the New York Times website, has that also changed the dynamic of the newspaper business as well?
Andrew? I mean, it's changed your online, it's impacted on your online business.
Yeah, obviously. But I don't think it's changed, or I hope it doesn't change the skepticism that journalists bring to whatever they're reading. I mean, regardless of if this information is coming through tweets or press releases or broadcast or whatever, you know, I would hope that they're considering the source, looking at these things closely and scrutinizing them. I mean, the Taiwan example you give, it just sounds like bad news judgment. I don't know how like Twitter can help or hurt that really.
But I think you hear that a lot. People say, well, there was some information on Twitter. It's a bit like saying, well, there was some information on the TV, or there was a fax that came through on the fax machine. It really depends who on Twitter was giving out the information. Twitter is not a big thing giving out information. It could be the Financial Times has put up a story on Twitter, so that's from the Financial Times. It's just a vehicle for information.
But the question was more about the time pressure. You don't have the luxury. I mean, if you're a print daily, not an online edition of a newspaper.
I would say almost, you know, everybody's learning. I would say that since people have been interacting with social media as news organizations over the past 2, 3, 4 years, everybody has been burnt at some point. Everybody's done something that you then realize, hey, oh, you can't do that because you're still learning how to use the technology or how to interact with people. And what most news organizations realize, or especially credible news organizations, is the worst thing we can lose is our credibility. So the need to be accurate, the need to get things right, it drives most of what we do. And there's nothing worse than getting things wrong. I mean, there really isn't. I think you've seen people are much smarter. They become much smarter about how they use social media and how they pick up information from social media, mainly because a lot of them have learned painful lessons in the past.
Question here.
Hi, I'm Joseph Cheney from Thomson Reuters. I'm curious, it seems every website, news website today has a commentary section where readers can comment on individual stories. I'm curious, is that putting pressure on the editorial direction, on editorial standards within the newsroom, and does it guide or shape editorial policy in some way in responding to reader feedback?
I can't answer that for what it's doing inside a newsroom, but I can note that one of the most clicked on parts of the New York Times website is the most viewed stories. So that is certainly driving, you know, if I'm interested in knowing what is most viewed, and now the New York Times has this site, you know, this part that says they recommend people you know would like these stories. So it certainly is driving traffic. Whether that's affecting the judgment of the editors.
I think it is something that editors are looking at. I can't really say is this affecting which stories get assigned and which things get killed? I don't really know. I think it is something that probably a lot of outlets are starting to pay more attention to. And that's probably going to be something that we have to be sort of checking ourselves against, making sure that there is important journalism that gets published regardless of whether it will be popular or not.
Is everybody familiar with demand media? Demand media is the ultimate absurd model of this, sort of the world nightmare of journalism, where they have a business model based around paying according to the number of clicks. So they will only write a story if they think a certain number of people will search for it. Everybody in this room has been to their sites, by the way. eHow is one of them. They come up at the very top of a search if you're, you know, how do I make a souffle? That's going to be demand media. And they're built around this business model where people are paid according to the click. So that's the absurd logic end of it. And what I'd hope is that news organizations are going to do what they are supposed to do, which is play the responsible role in society. And you're going to have that long article on the, you know, ins and outs of the Supreme Court that will not be popular, as popular as, I don't know, if people like souffles, but other topics, hair transplants.
Tom, can you give us a breakdown on the use of, you've got a world map in your head. How can you give us a breakdown in the use of social media in different countries around the planet? For example, I know Indonesia is very high. You know, how does it break down?
If you look in the Asia Pacific region, if you look just the usage of Facebook, I already said, China has a very high level of social media usage. In terms of Facebook, Indonesia is the second largest Facebook nation in the world, following the United States. After that comes India, recently overtook the UK. So there's incredible levels of usage of social media. And what I find very interesting is traveling around the region. I used to travel around Asia looking at the politics, economics, and culture of all of these different countries in the region. Now I travel around looking at social media, and I see how social media itself is changing the politics, economics, and culture of these various countries in tremendous ways.
We have a question at the back, far back. Hello.
Jean-Pierre Hilton from BASF. A few minutes ago, earlier in the conversation, you were talking about correcting articles, and this is something that I find is very interesting. On one hand, something is on the internet, it lives there forever and ever and ever and ever. But on the other hand, you can get something correct. So it's not like when it's printed, that's the end of the world. If there's a mistake, you have to wait until, you know, page 38 the next. So my specific question is, how do you want to be corrected? Do you want an email saying, you know, gosh, this number is actually 16,000, not 16 million? Or do you want to comment on the article? Or do you want to tweet? Or what? Or a phone call, God forbid.
Bill?
Yeah, old-fashioned phone call or email is fine.
No, but it is a problem. And once it's out there, it tends to stay out there. I mean, if there's a problem with a photograph or a story in AFP, how do we...
It's extremely hard. I mean, it is extremely hard. Well, once you get something out there, we work with some of our particularly big clients, such as Google and Yahoo, and you can pester them and, you know, hunt them down, and you can finally get things removed. But it can take several days. But of course, by then it's already disseminated far and wide. It can then be picked up by other people and put its background into other stories. So it is extremely hard to keep control of that process.
I sometimes like it when there are errors. For example, on my blog, I once did this posting, which was about I was moving to China, and I wanted to know what was the best VPN to have in China. Virtual private network is how you get around the Great Firewall, so you could, if you wanted to, go to Facebook or YouTube. And I wrote this posting about it, asking people what it was, and they started writing all of these comments. And I have not written anything on that posting now for 3 years, but I have a pretty good track of when the Chinese government is cracking down on the Great Firewall, because it increases the number of visits to it and the number of people who have written corrections. The first ones that were up there, Whytopia was the top one when I did that. It's gone through these different iterations of people saying, no, this is a better one, that's a better one. So it turns into this conversation that I'm no longer involved in any level, taking place without me, So it's that's sort of an interesting sort of self-corrective mechanism going on.
Please, this gentleman over here.
Hello, Douglas Wong from Bloomberg. I just wonder what the panel think. Do you think that these social networks have obviously been a tremendous boon in terms of a new resource for us as journalists, in terms of getting an insight into what the Syrian street is doing, thinking, or what's happening in, you know, what the reaction is to train crashes in China? But is there a danger that we're going to lose the realization that we should be able to still go out there and report on the ground? What if a government turns off, as they almost did in London, all the social networks? Then are we going to get trapped in a situation where we're addicted to this kind of the social media as a mechanism for understanding what people are thinking? I'm just wondering what you think about that.
No, I agree that's a concern, and I think that's we have to remind ourselves every day that we are journalists, and what we do is we speak to people face to face, and that's how you really break stories. You make stories and break stories by getting out of the office, by actually meeting people and speaking to people. I mean, the examples of where we were talking about the Middle East, for example, I think is slightly different, because you're talking about scenarios there where you are physically unable to report. And I think in those scenarios, that's different. It becomes a substitute for reporting. But I think it's incredibly important that people get out. And it's one of the biggest challenges. I mean, everybody's watched rolling TV network news. You've seen the BBC guy on the roof of his hotel in Baghdad, where something big happens and he's just repeating what's going on because, you know, he has no time to get away. It's something we consistently make mistakes on. I mean, everyone will remember the fall of Saddam Hussein's statue. Now, if you saw that story reported, you know, what would have happened 10 years ago? The statue would have gone down. The reporters would have hung around, would have written about the whole scene that actually went on there, and there were only several hundred people there. But what in fact happened was, because we were writing in real time, you saw the statue go down. That was the big moment. The image was just the TV image, very, very strong. It's gone, and already this has become an iconic moment and completely misleading. So because you have to work for the minute, for the moment. So I mean, I think that's one of the biggest challenges we all face, is to try and get our people out of the office, to try and get people on the ground, and to try to get people sort of meeting people face to face, because it's absolutely essential to quality journalism. And you're right, it is an increasingly big challenge to do that.
Yeah, and Andrew, from your answer earlier, Wall Street Journal obviously still prefers your direct source, right?
Right. I mean, I agree. I think it is a danger. And I think good journalists should be able to do both. You have to be able to go out into the world and talk to people face to face. But I guess one thing I would add is that reporters now also have to be able to understand online communities and understand what's playing out on the internet. I mean, you will miss stories if you aren't able to read those things and cultivate sources and follow discussions there too. So I think both are important.
And I think one further point is nothing beats shoe leather for reporting a good story. What is said in online communities can often be somewhat misleading as well, because we're posturing. Nobody knows who I am. I'm anonymous. Or, you know, you can be taking a position that you don't really hold when you come up to the person face to face. You know, they don't hold that strong a view.
And it's also very rarely a representative sample of the population. I mean, you know, there's a certain type of person who's going to be on Twitter commenting on an event.
Please.
Hi. Hi, Rachel Cartland. I'm just an old lady. This is just a question for Thomas Crampton. As I understand it, you say you spent several years just basically spending most of your time writing a blog. So
I did some other things as well.
Okay, but I'd like to know why you did that. What made you start it and keep it up for so long? Did it make you any money? And at the end of the process, when you've been doing it for so many years, did you think it was worthwhile or not?
Have I made any money on my blog? I put up a Google ad once, which, because I had a fair amount of traffic there, and it selects the ads it wants to put up next to your content, and I was totally horrified by the ads that it put up next to my content. I won't repeat what they are in a family audience here. So I took that down. So I've never made any direct revenue off of my blog. Why did I do it? Because I was fascinated, and still am fascinated, by this transition from the Gutenberg era to the era of the internet and social media. And I distinguish between internet and social media eras. And I wanted to understand conversational media to the full extent. And the only way I could really do that is not be distracted by writing for magazines or newspapers and really throw myself into it. And I found it incredibly rewarding, not financially, as I've said, but because of the relationships that were built out of it, the people I never would have met. With the blog, I would travel to, still sometimes do it. I don't do as much as I should right now, but put up on the blog. I'm going to be in KL tonight. If anybody wants to have a chat about what's going on in social media, I'd love to learn. And you get 50 people turning up. I mean, it's a different sort of relationship with the people involved in reading your articles. So I really found it incredibly rewarding.
And not a big pressure. I mean, it's not like feeling every day you've got to put something up for.
The great thing about a blog is it's yours, and you don't have an editor. Present company accepted, of course.
Hello, Yolanda Ma from Thomson Reuters. And I was social media editor for South China Morning Post for the past year. So I think of this question from an organizational point of view for a long time. So the question is, when I was at Post, what I observed is that actually, even though we talk about social media all the time, not all the reporters and editors are that familiar with social media. So the younger generation are more struggling with the information overloaded, and then older generation, or I should say the more experienced ones, are more struggling to start their Twitter account. So there are different problems with different people. So how are you tackling or giving trainings to your staff at your organization?
Yeah, I hired Tom to come and talk to them and explain what's going on. It is a challenge, and certainly, it's not necessarily an age issue. Actually, there are more senior members of staff who completely, especially bitten by Twitter and Facebook, there are more junior members of staff who are disengaged in that process. Again, I think training is absolutely essential, and part of it again is demystifying it. We keep talking about information gleaned from Twitter and information gleaned from Facebook, but we never talk about some information was on the TV in some sort of mystical way. It's really the same. So a lot of the training and discussion is just to sort of try to put all the bits together and explain to people how everybody is consuming news. One thing we haven't spoken about much tonight is the fact that we're focusing on social media, but none of it would be possible without the revolution that is, one, the internet, and two, mobile telephony. I mean, it's the mobile devices, the things that everybody has in their hands now that are really changing the way people interact on the internet and consume on the internet. And I think once people understand the cycle of why you're filing a story or an image or something at a certain time, you're trying to understand how people are consuming it. Once you understand how people consume on mobile devices around the world, that really helps. So there's a lot of training that just puts everything into context, because it can be a bit of a blur to people.
What's the policy in the Wall Street Journal? Is it left to the individual journalist to have an account, or does everybody have to have a Twitter account? Is there training? How does it work?
We don't force people to be on Twitter. And we found kind of the same thing with our staff. I would say if we're to very broadly generalize, the cautious things that we're saying to younger reporters are more along the lines of oversharing, and the things that we're saying to more experienced reporters are about not being afraid of it. Or what to do if someone says something negative about your story online. I think what helps, regardless of generation, what helps get people around a lot of these sort of issues that they might run into is just making sure that they're solid on the editorial and ethical standards, regardless of the platform. And once people feel sort of confident in those things, a lot of the kind of questions or nervous things that they have about social media aren't as relevant.
Tom?
Well, I thought it was a question for more the editorial side, but I think that, I don't know, I thing that I've really valued a lot is the feedback and the dialogue that I get out of it. But what I found is as Phil said, it's not necessarily an age-dependent thing. I found younger people who are not so interested in it and older people who are obsessed by it. And some people like that engagement. They like having it as a conversation. Others find it off-putting.
And, I mean, you do training. I mean, you've done training at AFP. What are the most asked questions from... when you have a mixed group of journalists in front of you of different generations, what are the... And you're talking about using social media in journalism. What are the most asked questions?
How am I going to do that in addition to my current job? Right. Which I think is... The answer to that is your current job or your previous job does no longer exist. And you're going to have to figure out how to integrate that in with what you're doing. I mean, it's that was a previous era. It's now changed. I remember you were talking about the difference that social media brings in terms of editorial decisions and that sort of thing. I remember at one point the Herald Tribune wanted me to try out working on the desk, which was an ill-fated experiment. And I sat down in front of this list of stories that had come over in chronological order. And I was like, wait a minute, how has this been sorted? And it hadn't. It was just the story was at the top because it was at 12:03. The next one was 12:05, 12:06, 12:07. And it was a very interesting experience to not have a socially searched or socially listed series of news bites such as you get with Google News or another system or even Twitter, where you'll have recommendations coming at you rather than just strictly, you know, it's pork bellies followed by assassination.
I think we've got about 5 minutes left, so anybody that hasn't asked a question yet? First? No? This lady here.
Going forward, which social media platform, introduction, Ann Gilman from Hamilton Advisors. Going forward, which social media platforms do you see will be the most influential? Does Google Plus have a role? Are people going to get sick of the 140 character limit of Twitter? And how do you see location social media platforms playing a role?
One for you, Tom.
It depends where you're geographically. I think that all of the platforms you've spoken about are very interesting and will be important going forward. Mobile is definitely huge. Mobile cannot be exaggerated at this point, particularly when you look at countries, what's going to happen in Indonesia, what's going to happen in India with mobile. Very, very important. I think location is taking a very interesting turn with standalone services like Foursquare. I think Twitter is an interesting example of something that you would think would be integrated into a Facebook, but hasn't. It's managed to go on its own, and I think that's because of the inherently different nature. And I think that's one important thing to look at when you're trying to understand how a social network works, or a social media platform works. What is its inherent nature? And you can sort of do a summary of all social media in three sentences or less. I'll try. Facebook is all about the people that you used to know. LinkedIn is about all the people that you want to know. Twitter is about all of the people that you should know. So they serve very different purposes. While they might seem that they are, I mean, people always ask me, you know, how do you sign onto these social media services? I love it because I feel like I'm exploring this. I feel like I'm a space explorer, trying out these new things that we don't know what's going to work and fail. And I don't get sick of signing up for them because I'm so interested to see what's going to work. Twitter shouldn't exist, really. It's such a silly idea, but it's been huge. As for Google Plus, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it goes, how it survives going forward, or how not survives. I don't want to sound so negative. It's the fastest growing social media platform in the history of the internet. How much of that is due to Google using their power to pull people in, and how long will that carry on? I have no idea, but I'm going to be very interested in watching it.
Andrew?
I mean, I can tell you some of the things that we kind of are keeping our eye on when it comes to where to invest or where to be looking. Obviously, we're looking at the services that have the biggest audiences. Where do readers and viewers and prospective readers seem to be headed? Which ones are geared toward publishing? Google Plus seems really interesting sort of as a consumer, but it doesn't do a whole lot for a news outlet that wants to be present on there. We're also looking at, you know, one of the things that's sort of fascinating and maddening about Asia is how fragmented the social media use is. And so, you know, if there's a player that lets us operate in multiple languages, it's probably going to be something that we really are interested in. And also, which of these, you know, some of these, like Twitter, tend to sort of let send people out. There's lots of things that are clickable on it. And others, like Facebook, kind of encourage you to, like, really delve into Facebook. That doesn't mean that we aren't interested in Facebook, but that is something that we try and take a look at and at least understand.
Phil, anything to add?
I'll leave it to these guys.
If I can ask, I don't see any other hands raised, so if I can ask a final question, I mean, I saw this, I think it was a New York Times story at the end of last week saying the genie is definitively out of the bottle, that social networks can't be controlled, and then at the same time, obviously, in China, they're looking seriously at it. David Cameron was talking about trying to control the social networks from a slightly, not a media aspect, but from a controlling society aspect. I mean, I suppose there's two ways of doing it. You would either do it technically, or you could just do it by obliging people through the threat of draconian penalties of imposing a form of self-censorship. So we can't stop you doing it, but if you do it, you go to jail. So is the genie out of the bottle forever? Have we entered a new world of freedom where we can exchange these ideas, or do you think down the line the individuals or the governments whose interest is in controlling it, do you think either the legislation or the technology will catch up? How do you see that?
I think the genie is out of the bottle. I mean, I think it's very, very hard. And that's why you see such nervousness amongst governments when they see what's happening. Again, the Middle East is a very powerful example. There's been huge efforts to try and shut down each of these revolutions in each of these countries, and they haven't succeeded. And certainly that's the focus of what's going on in China. They're extremely, obviously, sensitive to what people are doing on the internet. They fear certainly the power of the internet, and they're very nervous about the ability of the internet to bring people together. I think what we're seeing is certainly the genie outside out of the bottle. And I think if you see what happened after the Wenzhou train crash, again, you saw that the government wanted to have a little bit of dialogue out there. They wanted people on Sina Weibo to be commenting to some degree, but they didn't want it to go too far. And again, they weren't able to control the process. They perhaps lost control of the process. So, yeah.
Andrew?
I think it can, in a lot of cases, it can shine a light. It can call attention to things. It can embarrass people who deserve to be embarrassed. But that doesn't always equal action. Social media by itself is not going to change all of these things without people being engaged, without things actually happening in the real world. So I think it's something for us to sort of see how it plays out.
Last word, Tom?
I mean, I can't add much to these guys. Like I said, but I'd just like to highlight one of the more, I mean, governments and social media have a long problematic history. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the sort of semi-comical one in France, where the government has actually banned the use of social media platforms during news broadcasts because they think that if they talk about how something was, you know, taking place on Facebook or, you know, follow us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, that is a commercial endorsement, which is an interesting take on it. And you can argue one way or the other, and in France they've come down that they argued quite hard the other way and come down on it. Just to say that there are, governments do have a lot of issues with social media for a lot of the reasons that both Andrew and Phil raised.
Okay, thank you. Just slightly following on, we're having another panel on the 28th of September, Wednesday. And it's on the coverage of business in China, and how do you do it? How do you get around the obviously the very tight censorship of a lot of sensitive information in China? So it looks interesting, and obviously social media comes into this as well. So we've got four senior editors will be discussing it, and it's also it's organized with the Society of American Business Editors and Writers who'll be in town, and should be an interesting time opportunity to meet these people and also to have another discussion. So I'd just like to finish by thanking you all for coming, and please a big thank you to our panelists.